The following talk was given by Steve Matushak at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on December 6, 2025. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's great to see you. Thank you for Sesshin. As you know, without this, without Sesshin, there's no Sesshin. And that's a little hard for us to wrap our head around, because Sesshin, the way we usually think of Sesshin is in an abstract way, that there's this thing called Sesshin. And then there might be a Sesshin that's happening and a Sesshin that's not happening. But unless Sesshin is happening, no Sesshin. That's how it goes. That's how it works. And, you know, when I think about Sesshin, I've had a few people, some who I think I shouldn't say should know better, but I'm going to say should know better, you know, say like, have a blissful Sesshin, you know, and you're just like, well, you know, and I don't want to say that Sesshin is anti-blissful, but it's not sufficient to what happens at a Sesshin. What is a Sesshin? You know, try to tell somebody who doesn't do this what a Sesshin is, and good luck with that, because, I mean, you can describe it, but they would have no idea why you do it unless you had a blissful Sesshin, and then it would make sense. I talked to a person who's been doing this for a long time, and this person told me that the experience they used to have, and I don't know if they do any longer, but for years, would come out of a Sesshin with the Sesshin glow afterwards, you know, where you just be in Sesshin mode for a while. There'd be something that opened for you. And it would go on for a few days, and then it would be back to the old grind. And then there was that sense of, why did I spend all that time? Because all I got out of it was a couple days of glow. Do you know what I mean? And then it faded out. Now I'm back to this again, right? So Sesshin isn't any of that stuff. Sesshin, I think, is encouragement, even when it feels like discouragement. I still remember Cindy talking about her first Sesshin. And how long was yours? 5 days? First Sesshin was 5 days. I couldn't even imagine. I'd have leapt out a window. Now, granted, here that wouldn't have made much of a difference. I would have twisted an ankle or something like that. But I wouldn't have been able to make it 5 days. Or so I think, and that's part of Cindy's story about it. She didn't think she could either. She was such misery at the beginning there that she was thinking, not only am I never coming back to this place again, I'm never coming down this street again, you know. But it actually is encouraging, because what she discovered when the 5 days were done, she did it. That's it. She did it. And that's how it works. It's hard for us to get to that point, though. You know, to get to the point where we've done it. Because a lot of times we're just putting up such a fight that we may not make it. You know, we may not get to the end. But Sesshin is encouragement, then, to settle into this and to see our distraction. You know, to see how we reach for things, how we grasp things. And I'd even say, and this one's a little tougher because it starts to sound like we're talking interpretation, but why we do this, right? You don't have to interpret much. The why is just a thing you can sense. Why did I just start thinking about peanut M&Ms? Which I don't have right. You know, why am I going there? And you don't really even have to do that, but you can notice. You can see Sesshin is an invitation to stop and look and listen, whatever it is, pay attention. And it's an encouragement that that's it. It's just that. That's what Sesshin is. That's just what is taking place right here, right now. So that kind of leads into, as you all know by this point, Dylan, perhaps you don't know, but I've been giving talks for the last few years from Steve Hagen's book, Buddhism is Not What You Think. I only got a little over a dozen more to go. One of them is 2 pages long, so I don't think I'm going to be giving a session talk on that one unless I really figure out how to open it up. But anyhow, I'll be giving a talk today on a chapter titled Before Ideas Sprout. Before Ideas Sprout. And I always like to pause at the titles just to kind of think about what they seem to evoke, what they potentially could conjure for us. And for me, that first thing you get it to is before ideas. You know, before ideas. As a phrase, before ideas, that time, that mythical time, before ideas, right? If you've been encountering this teaching, you know, ideas, and by the way, they don't say this, but it might sound like ideas bad. Before ideas, good, right? So you go, before ideas, this is this mythic, Edenic space where I am not to be plagued by thoughts. No suffering is there, right? That is what we think before ideas is, and it's before ideas. So there are these things that are coming in, they're called ideas, but we're talking about that place before the bad neighbors move in. Do you know what I mean? Before the ideas show up. Before then. It's a time before then. And this is sort of interesting, that time before. I took a class in graduate school that was called Backgrounds in Modernism. That was the kind of program I was in, that they would have a class named that. Backgrounds in Modernism. And it was taught by, oddly enough, a history instructor rather than a literary teacher. And he, when he took over the class, he goes, why is it called backgrounds, right? So he decided to take that very seriously. And what he did was he went all the way back to, we'll say classical literature. So we read part of the Iliad in that class, just part of it. This guy was like, oh, you just need to read the beginning and the ending chapters of books and you get the whole book, you know. So we just read one section. Very famous section in the Iliad, and we read 2 different translations of it, and then we looked at how does each translation represent antiquity and modernity, which is, and the modern really, not modernity, but the modern, which is right now. That's what the modern is, just now. How does it represent that? And a lot of times, antiquity was, this time before, was viewed with some nostalgia. Things were better back then. They were giants back then. And we are, you know, merely standing on their shoulders. We're these pathetic creatures that are not near, you know. So there's that idea of before ideas, before that time. Gets inflated and, like I said, has this mythic quality to it. But it can't really be the way that we think it is. Right? It can't really be that way. And the reason why is for before ideas to be the way we think it is, which is this time before ideas showed up, guess what would have to happen for that to be before ideas? You would have to have ideas first. At least that's the way it would seem. And of course we know chronologically that doesn't make sense, but without ideas, no before ideas. It doesn't make any sense. It wouldn't be before ideas. It would be something else. It would just be that stuff. So the way we tend to think of it doesn't really make sense. And if we look at our actual experience, we see that it not really, I mean, I know what this before experience is pointing out, and we're going to break that down a little bit more. And I'm going to spend some time on this title just to kind of lay the groundwork of the chapter. But if we really look at our experience, the ideas are showing up or they're not showing up. And that's really how it shows up. Either ideas are showing up. Or they're not showing up. The other thing that we do, we go, oh, well, just a couple of minutes ago, wasn't showing. That's an idea. There's an idea showing up right there. So they're either showing up or they're not showing up. And even when we think they're not showing up, they tend to be showing up. We just don't know that they're showing up. We're not paying close enough attention. And if we notice that they're either showing up or they're not showing up, they don't really seem to have an order. It's hard for us to say, well, the absolute first origin of all of this is, you can't do that. It's just, sometimes they show up, sometimes they don't show up. The only way that we think of it is a before idea chronologically, like a time before, is if we turn it into that, if we create a narrative that's telling us that. So, in other words, intellectualizing our experience, right? Which we do, and we might be doing it in Sesshin. Maybe you've done it already, right? And I want to just lean into the irony of the statement, but I know I've expressed it. I'll tell you the version of it. Well, first of all, I'll tell you what it is, and I'll tell you the version that I came up with that I didn't even realize when I was expressing it, how ironic it was until, I don't know, I would say years later, hopefully I wasn't that slow. But what we might think is, while we're sitting, there you go. This is it. This is experience before thought. You know, this is really it. This is reality, right? So that's what you do. What I did is I set my first half day meditation here. And I remember thinking I was not going to do well because it was pretty early in my practice yet, you know, and I was just like, oh, this is going to be rough. In fact, when it was done, I remember telling people, I said, I experienced every emotion I've ever had in my life in that, you know, however long, those are 4 hours long, in those 4 hours, you know, but while I was in the middle of it, I had to use the restroom and I remember thinking, you're doing all right. No thinking, no talking. Yeah, I'm telling myself this, and it took me a while to realize. I was giving myself a pep talk, but there it is, right there, you know. So, there are our ideas. But to get us out of before ideas land, or time, he's got that other word that I think is a surprising word, is before ideas sprout. I was saying sprout. That's a kind of a bright little word. You know, and I thought, well, what is that? What does that mean? Like, why sprout? Why did he choose that word? I mean, I immediately think of plants when I think of sprouting, and I'll talk about that eventually. But of course, sprouting isn't just used to refer to plants. So it just means to grow or spring up, come forth, and it's come forth as or as if a sprout. I don't even think what a sprout is. It's to send out new growth, to appear suddenly and in large numbers. So now we have before ideas sprout, before they grow or spring up or before, and this is that one that's sprouting is to appear suddenly in large numbers. Remember in the 1970s when malls were sprouting up everywhere? If there was in the Twin Cities area, if there was a potato field somewhere, a mall was probably going to sprout up where that was, right? So we know what that's like. So now we're talking about before ideas appear, before they spring up and proliferate. And think about how ideas do that. It just takes one. It's like planting a seed. You just have one and then you've got this conflagration of ideas. So we can still get a sense of time with the word sprout being there. We can still think, well, it's before those things sprout. But I feel like that phrase, before ideas sprout, and thinking about what sprouting is, which again is the appearance and the proliferation of them, can also give us a sense of, instead of it being before chronologically, just the beginning. Just right here, the beginning. Sprouting as budding at the beginning, as things are just appearing. Just as they start to proliferate, right? On the cusp, on the verge. So they haven't quite, they're just shown up, right? So we maybe have, well, I don't know, think of a weed, those purple bellflowers. Minnesotans know. Do you have those in Oklahoma? Purple bellflower? Well, it's a weed because people don't want them around. The reason they don't want them around is they grow like liquid fire. They're just everywhere. So they're a weed, yeah. They have like purple, pale purple flowers that look like bells. And that's why they call them bell flowers. And they'll grow everywhere. Everywhere, right? So, well, I guess what I'm trying to use that as an image because they just, once you got them, then you got them. And then they're probably going to go everywhere. And if you live Like, we have a garden that's right next to our neighbor's yard, and Todd likes purple bellflowers, and I'm just like, you know, that could be getting into our neighbor's yard, because they grow by rhizomes, I think, so they kind of shoot out, and they grow from that, and that's part of the problem that they have. So our neighbors could be getting purple bellflower, and they may not want purple bellflower. But what I'm trying to really say is that we're on the cusp, the verge of an outbreak of purple bellflower. We're just seeing the shoot. It's just right there. And that's what we experience in meditation, right? We can actually, if we settle down into this moment, we have the experience of just that budding of thought, of an object of mind. It's just budding there. And perhaps our desire to grasp it then. So there's this object, and we go, or I would even say it could also be we really want there to be something to pay attention to. So first we grasp for it, and then an object goes into our hand. So I was reminded of when I thought of that. And you know what I'm talking about, because our objects can just be thinking about stuff. So we might be sitting there, and then the why shows up, and we get restless. It might be we feel bored, or we don't even know what that feeling is like. And then we start thinking about stuff. So there we are grasping for, there's nothing there yet, but there we got it now. And I remember a professor of mine in graduate school. He was he had been in the theater, but he was a very theatrical professor. So he was 72 years old. I just want to say this. He was just this little like ball of energy, you know, 72 years old. And he started talking, and I don't remember the point he was talking about, but he was talking about, so thinking about what comes first, the object of mind and then the grasping, or the grasping for and then the object of mind, right? He was talking about something, and he said, what comes first, the sparrow's tail or the grasping of it? And I didn't even know what he was talking about at first, but then he pulls his chair out and he stands on it. So this little chair in a seminar, and he starts doing Tai Chi, and he goes, the grasping sparrow tail or what comes first, sparrow tail or the grasping? He's doing this Tai Chi stuff and that kind of thing, right? That sounds like, what? But you can actually understand that. Again, with meditation, we can start to see before ideas sprout. And then the other definition of sprout, the one that has to do with plants, is, I didn't even really know this. Like, I hadn't thought, I just thought it was plant sprouts. It just kind of, you know, and I was like, what does that mean? The plant sprout is the plant shoot. It puts forth shoots. And the shoot is the part of the plant that appears above ground. So then I went, well, that's even a richer word. So not only are we right there at the beginning as things are just starting to appear before they proliferate, right? But you also have something that's appearing. Because before, I remember when I was a kid, my grandpa used to go out and he planted some of his plants in his garden by seed. And we would help grandpa water the garden. It was a big freaking garden, so he needed help. But we couldn't tell if the plants were growing or not. You know, are the carrots okay? Are they going to grow? You know, we couldn't tell until a little green thing would come up. And then we didn't know if that was carrot or non-carrot plant, you know. But we couldn't see until we saw. And then when we saw, then there was carrot, right? That was a sign of carrot, that little thing coming up out of the ground. So the other thing about sprouting is it's about what's appearing. It's really not about the root of what's appearing. But we take it, you know, it's a sign for something, but it's not the root. It's not how this has come to be, right? The way we usually encounter the world is, here it is. This is the world as it is. But Buddhism and Buddha teaches us to see the world as it has come to be. That's the root, right? That is when we do our meal chant, innumerable labors. Those innumerable labors, sure, they include the guy driving the truck and the people that grew the plants, but it's innumerable. It's not just limited to that. It just keeps going and going. So in that sprouting then, it's in appearances that our ideas start to sprout, right? So I really like that word sprout. So I have now just unpacked the title of this chapter, but it's just to lay the groundwork for what we're going to be looking at. So, Foyan, an ancient Chinese Zen teacher, observed, "You can be called a Zen student only when you perceive before signs appear, before falling into thought, before ideas sprout." That's Foyan. Then Steve says, "What's this about perceiving before signs appear? And what exactly are signs?" Signs are the marks by which we identify things, particularly when we give significance to those qualities. They are the concepts, descriptions, ideas, and values we attribute to things that give them reality in our mind. Heat is a mark of fire, so are light and smoke. But a sign is something more. Signs contain meaning for us. Yet, signs are actually forms of delusion. We think they're indications of reality, yet they are purely constructs of our own minds. Thus, all the myriad signs that appear are just our thoughts, our retelling and conceptualizing of what's actually experienced directly. All right. So again, we have Foyan saying, you can be called a Zen student only when you perceive before signs appear, before falling into thought, before ideas sprout. And then Steve goes into talking about the signs. And I think he does that because we don't see signs as delusion. Right? We think of signs, we might think of them kind of like he's talking about marks here. And Steve says signs are marks, but they're marks that have more meaning than marks. So marks, we could say, is something like the mark of something is like a characteristic of it, just to simplify it for us. So a mark of fire is heat. A mark of fire is light. A mark of fire is smoke. It doesn't have a lot of meaning. It just, you know, if you got fire, you're expecting it to be hot, right? Though, was Steve telling us that story once at a session where he went up to the, you know, North Country here in Minnesota, and Cindy, it gets really cold up there. And he was talking about how they had like a bonfire going. It was so cold they couldn't even feel heat off the fire, you know. And you don't expect that because a mark of fire is heat. That's the reason why you have a bonfire. So that's a mark. But a sign, he says, a sign has more meaning for us, right? Those of us who live, again, in these climes, well, you probably have different signs for this. But we have, I know that people that I know, and I engage in this as well, is we have signs of global warming, right? So we go, yep, that's because of global warming. Yep, that's because of global warming, right? Whether it's true or not, that's just, it seems like it because it's this trend of things that are happening. We go, that's a sign of global warming. It's a... Those are the kinds of things that look like marks. They look like they're just characteristics of something, and then we can tell what it is. But if you really think about what we're doing with, say, the signs of global warming, is we're just kind of guessing, you know, we're seeing something, and it seems like it makes sense based on our understanding of da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and that's how signs work. Or here's another one, signs that somebody's attracted to you, right? They might have a little sparkle in their eye when they talk to you. They might laugh at your dumb jokes. They might pay attention to you. Do you know what I mean? So then we make these interpretations of what's going on. And if you've ever been a fool in love, do you know what I mean? Like, you think you get all the signs, and then you go, I think this is, something's going on here. And then you kind of go for it, and you realize you were completely off the mark. You know, just these signs. They're these things that seem to have meaning for us, that we take as being like fire having heat or fire having smoke, right? So those are signs. And as Steve points out, those are forms of delusion. They're actually just ideas that we have about what it is that's going on. Steve goes on, he says, we cannot and do not experience reality through signs. That's how we live our lives. If you start looking, you're going to start noticing that the way you're moving through the world is by signs. And you're taking them as being something more than that. But he says, we cannot experience reality through signs. Reality occurs prior to our falling through. One of my bookmarks fell off here. We cannot do not experience reality through signs. Reality occurs prior to our falling into thought, prior to our getting ideas, prior to our coming up with explanations. Reality is before things form in our minds as crystallized objects, one thing distinguished from another. Fo Yan, and by the way, Fo Yan is a Chinese master who's associated, I believe he's associated with the Huayan school, I believe, if memory serves me correctly. I know that guy I'm thinking of, his name started with an F. And there's not too many of those. So, but Fo Yan also said, Zen practice requires non-attachment to thought. So remember, the first thing was, you can be called a Zen student only when you perceive before signs appear, before falling into thought, before ideas sprout. But he says Zen practice requires non-attachment to thought. Here, Steve tells us, Fo Yan is not asking us to stop thinking. This is very important because this is what we think they're doing. Right? I just saw Minnesota Zen Center the day after Thanksgiving. They have something they call Blank Friday. And Blank Friday is where you go sit in meditation. And I went, but that's not what we're doing in meditation. It's not blank anything. That's wrong. It's just misleading. Because it's what people think. They think it's about being blank. It's not about being blank. So anyhow, it's not about to stop thinking. Instead, he is urging us not to take our thought objects as reality. Instead of getting caught up in them, we can simply stop imagining that they have any substantiality. All right, that's it. So I just want to really quickly get back to that prior, because now Steve's got prior in there. He goes, prior to falling into thought, prior to our getting ideas, prior to our coming up with explanations, right? And then he goes into before, and prior seems very much like before. In fact, I looked it up, and it says existing or coming before in time, order, or importance. Now, it's those other ones that are worth noting. But the reason I'm bringing this up is that when we encounter a teaching like this, before ideas sprout, prior to us, what does he say? Prior to falling into thought, prior to getting ideas, we automatically put it into time. We see that as a time thing. And this is important because time is an illusion, right? Time is a working of consciousness. That's what it is. It's a product of consciousness. It's taking this, which, again, we're encouraged in Sesshin to see what this is. We see that it has no beginning, that it has no end to it. We see that. It's right now. And right now, the way we'll refer to it often is this moment, but this moment is not really now. People will use them interchangeably because, well, now is just the way that this moment is showing up. But now, well, this is now. All right, so consciousness takes now and breaks it up into things that we can grab hold of, moments or minutes or hours or days or weeks or however long you want to break it up. But it breaks that up into time. And consciousness is not what Steve is talking about here. That's why this is important to note, because it's where we go when we hear words like before and prior. But we can think of prior as talking instead about what he's talking about. Reality is that without which consciousness cannot function, cannot appear. So that's what he's talking about. So when we're talking about prior, it's sort of like it's just necessary for consciousness. We need to have this reality or awareness or whatever you want to call it. But that's necessary. And then consciousness is a working of that. It's just a working of whatever that it refers to. I'd say a working of it. So consciousness is not actually separate from this reality, right? So again, this is important. We're talking about before ideas sprout and we think, okay, ideas and then that's consciousness. You're not going to be pulling consciousness out of there. Consciousness is going to be operating. It's seeing what consciousness is, though, which is a working of this reality that breaks the experience up into pieces that we can comprehend. You can't comprehend the other thing. It's not comprehensible. It's without beginning. It's without end. It's without any kind of boundary. How do you, right? So consciousness just breaks that all up. So the objects of consciousness, that's anything. That'd be a thought. It'd be a bird song, right? It could be like an itch that you have, whatever it is. The object of consciousness is a manifestation of reality, just like consciousness is. And I'm saying that because these objects of consciousness, before thoughts arise, right? Thoughts are really reality being manifested as thoughts. They're not separate from reality. And the way that we usually separate them from reality is we got thoughts. We go to these things. And when we've got these things, now we lose track of reality. We lose track of the root and we're looking at the sprout. And we're getting caught up in the sprout. And when we do that, it's going to proliferate, right? So we then separate the thing from the whole that it's a part of. We do it all the time. We really do. It's just what we do. And so we're mistaking the appearance. We're kind of blotting out our understanding of the whole by being caught up in the appearance. I'd say we mistake the appearance as the whole, but we don't think of it that way. Really what we're doing is there's the appearance and then that's the thing. And you're not going to spend a lot of time negotiating with that. I'm not going to sit there looking at that clock and going like, well, now I have to picture, you know, the dinosaurs that roamed the earth that died and then decomposed and then their decomposition led to the development. You know what I mean? Like, it's all there, but you can't walk around the world every time you encounter an object and just start mentally breaking it down into, because first of all, that's endless and you'll never stop. Yeah. That'd be kind of an interesting play. I mean, it would have to stop at some point, but just somebody who's just... There's kind of a character like that in a Samuel Beckett play. He's trapped more by history, more by ideas, but he can't do anything. Like, it takes him a really long time to do something because the whole weight of everything that's happened before him is going to happen in that gesture that he makes, you know? Because it's kind of what's happening every time we move. All the history is showing up as that, you know. So if you start thinking of it in terms of like, so the next thing you have to do has to be worthy of all that. Woo-hoo, you know what I mean? So we don't sit there and unpeel it. And that's why we get caught. Honestly, it's because the habit of mind then is just to clench up on the object and then to lose sight of the whole. So when we do that. So when we fall for thought, which is the way that, you know, Fayan and Steve put it, what we're doing is we're just attaching to the objects of our attention. That's what we're doing. So we fall for thought, something's showing up, and we take it up, and we carry it around with us. At least that's what we think we do. We think we've got something. You know, whatever it is. Non-attachment that Fayan is talking about is simply to see our urge to do so, to take it up. We just do it. I mean, but just to see that. Didn't you really want to do that? You know what I mean? To see the urge to do that and let the urge be. Really hard. Because that urge is urging you. Do you know what I mean? It's like a little, it's a goad. Thinking of a word that Samuel Beckett likes. So he's got a play where there's a goad. It's just like a big... You know, a goat is just like a stick that kind of pokes at you. You know, he has a big goat and it comes in and it pokes the characters. You know, you got to do something. That's what it feels like. So to non-attachment is simply to see our urges and then not to act on them. Or, and this is more likely, so we're lucky at Sesshin. We're given the opportunity to see those urges when they're arising. We may not, you know, that's all right. But here... More so than when you start getting out into a world with all these objects that you can attach to. Right here with the objects, you start to see what your mind is doing and how a lot of the things that you call the problems of your life are actually the result of you clenching down on something and making something that out of nothing in particular. You know, so you really don't have anything anyhow. So what we might do instead of seeing the urge arise is we can see that we're attached. We can see that we have an attachment going on here. Usually we bump into that when it's smacked out of our hands. The thing we think we have in our hands is smacked out. And then when we notice we're attached, we just come back to this. Because what we're noticing right there is, oh, I'm hanging on to this idea, or I think I am, right? And you don't even have to narrate it that way, but that's what you're noticing, and that's what's going on right now. So as you do that, you're settling back into the moment. Rather than, there's the moment, it's unfolding, but you're so busy with your things that you can't see it. You know, it's distorted, it's in a distortion field. So Steve goes on, he says, Foyan echoes the Diamond Sutra, the great Diamond Sutra. I was just thinking, I haven't read it in a while. I had to reread it. Great, great sutra. Foyan echoes the Diamond Sutra, which says the Buddha cannot be recognized by marks or signs. The word, however, the Diamond Sutra uses for Buddha is Tathagata, a compound Sanskrit word that means coming and going thus. That is, coming and going in such a way that nothing actually comes or goes. Tathagata, as it's used here, is a metaphor for reality, for immediate, direct experience. Tathagata is a description of how things are, which, as the term indicates, is no way in particular, since all is continuous, thoroughgoing flux. It points to actual experience, to what's perceived before things sprout in the mind, before we fall into thought, before signs appear. The task of this moment, the issue at hand, is to pay attention to this right here, to what's actually going on before we make anything of it. It's to realize how the mind conjures up endless ephemeral worlds, and that if we would just look at these carefully, they would dissipate like smoke or mist, and we would wake up. All right. So, first, Steve's telling us that in talking about, you know, this non-attachment and talking about what non-attachment is. He's not talking about that. He actually just brings up non-attachment, but how it is our practice, that this is an allusion to the Diamond Sutra, which if you know the Diamond Sutra, one of the things that the Diamond Sutra keeps telling us is, you know, we have merits. Why do we have merit? Because there is no merit. That's why we have merits. And it'll say things like that over and over and over again, right? Which is the formulation, you know, Steve puts it in kind of a mathematical term. It's A is not A, therefore A, right? That's what the Diamond Sutra keeps showing us over and over again. It's showing us that the things we think are there aren't really there, and because they're not really there, there they are. You go, I don't get that, you know. That's okay. That's okay. So, but one of the things that Steve talks about then is talking about the Diamond Sutra, saying the Buddha can't be distinguished or recognized by marks and signs, right? What is the Buddha? What is Buddha? Buddha just means awakened one, or one who is awake. But it's really important to know what that one is referring to. Because it's not one individual. It's not an individual one. It's not a one. It's one. That is Buddha. One. Right? So it's not a one. It's not a particular one. It's one. And this one is, I'm gesturing with my hands, but it's whatever. It's really tiny. So it's, that's Buddha. Buddha is the natural expression of this. And I mean this. And how can that be distinguished by marks and signs? What exactly is this? Again, we could say, well, this is, and then start talking about describing this. But you're not describing this. Well, first of all, you could never do it, you know. And I know I've talked about this before, but I read a book once by a French guy, and he was just trying to exhaust, to write this whole, it's like a little plaza in Paris. And he just was going to write it in its completeness, and he realized he couldn't, because it was always changing. Things were coming and going all the time. He couldn't really get it all, you know. He still kept trying, you know, so what he wrote was pretty interesting, but he just couldn't get it all because it doesn't have any marks and signs. There's no way to, I don't know, come up with pictures for what this is. And that is what Tathagata is helping us to see, right? Tathagata, that name that the Buddha gave himself. That's just coming and going thus. Continuous, thoroughgoing flux. Nothing really to hang on to. Though, we think we can hang on to things. And you know why that is, right? Why you think you can hang on to things? I mean, I think this is why we think we can hang on to things. Why it's such a... Because, look! I mean, if this does not look like thorough, continuous flux. Right? I mean, if you're paying attention, maybe you're noticing your thoughts are kind of going around, and maybe you notice the light kind of gets brighter and dimmer. You know, somebody just walked by. Maybe you're noticing that. But one thing you're also noticing is, and you're going to be seeing this for the next few days, is that wall doesn't seem to be in flux, right? I'm going to be staring at things. That rock doesn't seem to be in flux. This situation that we've created, the sashin, right? That's going to be going on for a while. So it's hard for us because it does not appear to us that it's in flux. There's just enough stuff that seems like it's just hard for us to think of the chair as being in flux. It just simply is because we're trying to think this through. We're looking at the appearances, the sprouting, and then ideas are sprouting, right? And we're going, and that's it. And it's not like intellectual thought, because we usually don't run around thinking about chairs and going, is this in flux or is this really solid? You know, you just don't do it. There's just a chair there and there are walls there and Rick's there. And you know what I mean? Like, that's why we have such problems, because it doesn't seem that way to us. So very easy for us to get caught up in the appearances. Very easy for us to do that. So we think that we've got things. And those include ideas. Oh, I got it. You think you got it. So when you think you've gotten it, you've just fallen into thought. That's all you have to remember, because that's not what's being pointed to. Steve says that Foyan tells us that the task of this moment, well, this is actually Steve, the task of this moment, the issue at hand, is to pay attention to this right here. Right? So this task that Steve is talking about is just waking up. That's it, just waking up. And all waking up is just coming back to here. It's our zazen. It is just being here now, reality, being this moment. And to see our minds conjuring up ephemeral worlds. I like that. Worlds! Conjuring up ephemeral worlds. It's one of the things I liked about Uchiyama's teaching about how we usually think what we usually think existence is, and then his way of describing it that's more helpful. Because our way of thinking of the world is we get born, and there's this world that's here, and we get born into it, and then we blip, blip, blip. You know, you think about that Shakespeare metaphor, you know, we're all actors upon a stage. So we come out, and we do our little dumb show, and then we're back off stage again, right? Then the hook comes and pulls us off, and that's the way we think life is. But Uchiyama says, no, when you're born, a world is born with you. And when you die, a world dies with you. It's the whole world. I don't know Dylan's world. I know the reality in which Dylan's world's appearing, for sure. But I don't know Dylan's world. And that's true with each and every one of us. So sometimes I see the rabbits in my yard, you know, and I go, what is Fat Bunny's world? And Fat Bunny's world is just Fat Bunny, you know, the conditions that made Fat Bunny be Fat Bunny, all of that, and being Bunny and being in my backyard, and I'm partly sure he's getting fat because the sparrows make a mess out of our bird seed. They just scatter stuff all over. And then the squirrels and the chipmunks and the mice and the rabbits all feed what they can. Whatever it is that's good that comes spilling out of there. So, but anyhow, so that those worlds that we conjure up, it's a whole world that we conjure up, right? And when we're conjuring up those worlds, you know, we lose track of what's actually going on, right? So the task of this moment is to realize how the world the mind conjures those. He calls them endless ephemeral worlds, right? And he says if we would just look, then they would dissipate like smoke or mist. And this part is tricky too, because we'll do this practice. We'll just look. And then we still are conjuring up our worlds. In our just looking, we might say, yeah, I see I'm doing that. And I'm just going to keep doing it because it's the right thing to do, you know, whatever it is. Now we can actually see ourselves leaning. We can see ourselves making sense of the world, which we have to do, and then still acting out of that, which, to be honest, you have to do. But are you doing it in a way that sees through the delusion of the way you've constructed the world or not? And that's the part that's hard for us. Steve says, unfortunately, so this is along these lines, most of us don't allow our cherished thoughts, our beliefs, our hatreds, our infatuations, our opinions, our calculations, our obsessions, our joys, our sorrows to dissipate. In fact, we don't even notice that they can dissipate because we're so earnestly hanging on to them. We don't even notice that they're only thought. Without realizing it, we hang on most dearly to what causes us the most grief and pain. At the same time, we reject freedom, fearing that somehow we'll lose something valuable in the process. All right. So he says, I'm just going to skip first. He says, unfortunately, most of us don't allow our cherished thoughts to dissipate. Think about what he's saying there. We don't allow the things we cherish the most to dissipate. We just don't allow them to do that. They will. There's the nature of all phenomena. Comes and it goes, comes and it goes, right? Coming and going thus, Tathagata, that is the nature of it. But we don't allow the most cherished ones we have, we don't allow them to do that. We're going to hang on to these things. And what I really like about it, our most cherished thoughts, that includes, well, our beliefs, but it also includes our hatreds. Think about that. We hang on to those babies. Do you know what I mean? We do. Our hatreds, these are our infatuations, our sorrows. We don't allow them to dissipate. You know, and those hard ones are the ones we can't quite wrap our head around. But our lives get juice from what we hate. And we are occupied. We can like put on the great movie of our life just wallowing in our sorrows. You know, just watching my life is Dr. Zhivago, you know what I mean? And then just all the sorrow, all the heartbreak, and that's life. And we just don't allow that to dissipate. And as Steve says, we're not even aware they can dissipate because we've so held on to them. And then we can see belief coming in here. Because those things that we aren't aware of that can dissipate, those are our deepest held beliefs. And I would say, those are just beliefs. Because if it's really a belief, it's got to be deeply held. If it's really a belief. If you're running around going, these are the things I believe, and you don't really believe in them, they're not really beliefs. The beliefs are the things you believe in. You know, so those are the ones that we can't even really see that they're ideas. We can't see that they're going to dissipate because we don't see them in terms of flux. And I'll tell you a belief that's really hard for us. Really hard for us. And I know that this is kind of probing a little bit of a sore point for everyone. Because it seems like it's going to say something, I don't know, nihilistic or quiescent, and I don't mean any of that to go in here, but what's hard for us to see is our sense of right and wrong. Right? To see that that's one of these things Steve is talking about, one of our cherished beliefs, or rather, And this is important because this links us back to the beginning of the chapter. The signs of right and wrong. That shows up, that's right. That shows up, that's wrong. Okay? Good looks like this, bad looks like that. Good looks like this, bad looks like that. And why do we have problems letting that go? Because if our sense of right and wrong or good and bad, if that's to dissipate, then what? Seriously, then what? So then we hang on to it and we suffer. We suffer when we see people being bad. We suffer when we don't think we can do good. Or maybe we suffer when we're being bad. Those are two different things. And then this one, which is really hard for us to see. We suffer when the people who are bad are being good. Now, it's really hard for us to see. We usually don't even see it because we're so busy. We've already determined they're bad. There's no way that could even be possible. You know, I worked with somebody briefly as a student, as a Zen student, who struggled with anger management issues. Really struggled with that. I think this person was seeing somebody, like a therapist for that. And what this person would do, because this was expressed to me right to my face, when this person saw something they thought was wrong, they would think that that was totally untenable, and they would get really worked up about it. The energy level in the room when this person was talking about something they saw that was wrong would just jack up, right? Because for this person, this was not acceptable. This way of interpreting the world, for people to behave in this way that they saw as bad, was unacceptable. We can understand that, right? Now, I don't want to just attach this to good and bad. I'm using good and bad because good and bad is the kind of belief that Steve's talking about that we think is valuable and we can't lose. That's why I'm doing it. It's the kind of thing we go, can't give that one up. You know, and you got to watch what these teachings are saying. So are they saying, are you going to walk around without ideas of good and bad? No, that's not it. Foyan's not saying stop thinking. If you can actually walk around without ideas of right and wrong, please come to me and tell me how you did that. Because they're going to show up. We're talking about not falling into thought. So it's starting to see that as thought, right? To see that that's predicated on signs. To see that. To start to see that so that you aren't gripped by those ideas. Right? Can you see that you're being attached to signs when you come up with ideas of right and wrong or good and bad? And can you see that those ideas are provisional? So something that looks bad in one context might actually be good. You know, I thought of an example kind of recently of somebody shoving a child. And somebody had a story very similar to this. And it wasn't with a child, but you just say shoving a child, which I think we would go, that's pretty bad. But the scenario I came up with is because a car was speeding toward him. And I was just the way the person responded, so to get them out of the way of that speeding car. So the signs by which we determine this are ideas. And they're provisional, right? They're never of the whole. They're always based on an interpretation of what's going on, an interpretation of how things should and shouldn't be. So the question is, with our ideas of good and bad, when we move forward in the world, is the way we're going to do that by policing our ideas of good and bad? Because that's usually what we want to do. Police our ideas of good and bad. So that you have the story of Ryokan. So I'm doing a lot of reading about Ryokan right now, the Japanese poet. And he's a very amusing character. But Ryokan, do you know Ryokan, Andrew? Yeah. So he was like a 18th century, early 19th century Japanese, like beatnik. You know, he was a Buddhist, studied Buddhism, and then once his teacher said, "Yeah, you've done your studies," he just up and lived the life as a vagabond, basically, for a number of years, just wandering around, and finally settled in this little hut, you know. But the story that I heard about Ryokan that is pertinent here, there are probably a number of them, but because he was a itinerant monk and he was literally had no money, he had nothing. He had like usually a book, the clothes he was wearing, some pens because he was a calligrapher. He'd have some brushes and pens. Maybe paper, but that was kind of rare actually. So he was kind of, you know, came into this town and he was begging people and he was kind of disheveled and a little dirty. And then at the house that he was begging at, where I think they were feeding him, they discovered that some valuable was missing. And so they just immediately thought this stranger who'd walked into town looking disheveled like this had stolen it. And he wouldn't give it to him. So they prepared to, and this, I couldn't believe this is how they were going to punish him, but they were going to bury him alive. So they dug the grave for him to be buried in, and they were getting ready to put him in, and somebody from, I don't know, either that town or nearby said, "Wait a minute, what are you doing? That's the respected Zen master Ryokan. You gotta set him free at once." So they set him at free, and this whole time Ryokan had said nothing. And the guy said, "Why didn't you tell them that you're innocent?" He said, "Well, they'd already determined I was guilty. So there's really nothing I was going to be able to say that was going to change their minds, you know. So I just figured it was better not to say anything at all." But there you go. There's the attaching and policing our ideas of good and bad, policing them to the point you would kill somebody because of your ideas, right? So do we do that, or is there another way that we can act that doesn't depend on those ideas? It might be informed by. We might see something we think of as, that wasn't a good thing for that person to do that, but then how do we move forward and not make it about that? That is not falling into thought, not being pulled around by our thoughts about what to do. Zen practice requires non-attachment to thought. And Steve says, you can be non-attached to thought only if you realize that your thought objects are not real. So that's all the objects that are showing. Those are all the appearances. They're not real. And by real, he's got it in capital R, real. I just thought I'd tell that to you because it's hard to hear that. But they're not real in that they're not ultimately real. They're little more than objects in a dream. Fuyan reminds us that the thoughts and signs we conjure up are not the real world. They're only models of the world and cannot substitute for reality. Thus, he's pointing out that our mind objects, including our sense of self and our sense of the world out there, are precisely what are not real. This is another way of presenting Buddha's anatta teaching, the teaching that all things are without self. So, again, first thing Steve says is, you know, you can't non-attach to a thought by non-attaching to it. No, you can't do it that way. The non-attachment is still attached. If you're going to do it that way, the non-attachment is still attached to the attachment. You know what I'm saying? Like if you're going to say, "I'm not going to do that thing," right? Even if you don't do that thing, it's still attached to that thing you're attached to. It's completely identified by it. So non-attachment to a thought is not, you don't do it by non-attaching, right? So Steve's going to bring this up later, but it's a don't think of an elephant, right? You probably weren't even thinking of an elephant until I just said that. Now you're going, "Oh, now I got to not think of an elephant," right? So you can see how those things are connected. Instead, what Steve says is you must realize that your thought objects are not real. How do you do that? And I just thought, just recently I quoted the Dhammapada, verse 183. It may not help, but it's how you do it, right? So this might be something you need to work with for a while. But it's practice what is wholesome, avoid what is unwholesome, and purify your mind. And that's it. That's how we realize that our thought objects are not real. If I could just simplify that, just come back to here now reality. That's it. Just come back to here now reality. Notice when you're holding on to your models of the world rather than just perceiving the world. Notice if you are thinking of the world as being out there Which a lot of times when we're engaging in judgment mode, that's the way it works. There's stuff that's going on out there. This caused me to do, did it? There's a world out there. So if you've got the world out there, that's just another model. If you're talking about the world inside, that's another model too. That's another model. So the reality that's being pointed to by Foyan and Steve is not outside, not inside. And to quote, I think Norm would say this, no in between. No inside, no outside, no in between. And you can see that directly. I can even throw the word directly out because it sounds like something special. You have access to that all the time. But it's hard because of those objects. Steve will be talking about this actually in the next chapter, but just think about any sense object and you actually ask yourself, where is this taking place? So he'll be doing it with a sound, but he's done it with smell before. When you smell a rose, where is that smell taking place? The scent of the rose in your nostrils, in the air in between, right? You start to realize the whole thing is at play there. And that's how we start to realize the objects are not real, right? That they're just, there's a whole wholeness that's expressing as scent, as flower. And when you start to see that, no inside, no outside, no in between, and you start to see that everything is actually mutually interacting, that anything that is being experienced is, you can't even elaborate all the things that went into that showing up, just like that character in that Samuel Beckett play. All of history in this next action, right? It's the way that it is. Then you start to see that the actual little thing you're looking at, it's just the result of all this other stuff, right? It's showing up because of all this other stuff without all that other stuff. And that all that other stuff isn't even necessarily stuff, but because of that, it's showing up. And so then how can you say that it's this individual thing if it really requires everything else in order to be the thing that it seems to be, right? And that is anatta. Steve tells us this has to be seen. And then he does that thing where he italicizes seen. So he's not just talking about your eyes. This has to be seen. And it can only be seen directly rather than explained or grasped, because it's not merely an idea, but rather actual experience. The issue in Zen, as in Buddhism in general, is awareness. We need to see what's actually going on rather than focus on what we think. We do not have to be confused about actual experience. We do not have to be tossed about by our emotions, our thoughts, our preferences. We can and surely will have thoughts and feelings. Again, I want to reiterate, we can. He's given us permission. And he said, and you surely will have thoughts and feelings, but they don't have to rule us and ruin us. Zen practice is attending to this moment, seeing it for what it is, which is nothing in particular, nothing graspable. And one of the easiest ways to spot when you're getting sidetracked is simply to watch the leaning of your own mind. When you incline towards some object of desire or away from some object of aversion. And how do you stop your mind from leaning? Well, that's going to be the next section that I point us to. But let's just start at Zen requires this has to be seen. This non-attachment has to be seen and not understood. So Steve says we have to experience this. Now, in intellectual understanding, he says, what does he say about it? He says, it has to be seen directly, because it, rather than explained or grasped. I thought he said a little bit more than that, but here I am, and I'm talking about stuff, you know, and you probably read this stuff, you know. Intellectual understanding is not bad. It's not forbidden. You're not being asked not to have it. But what the teachers are always trying to point out is it's not the point. So you can have an intellectual understanding. It might even kind of be helpful, but that's not the point of the teaching. And we will often get stopped there. I can, in some of my classes, I know I can ask a question and I will get, quote, the right answer. I know I'll get it. And yet I also know that none of it's coming from the depth you know, the real experience. It's like a learned textbook answer, because this stuff's not really rocket science. It is once you, I mean, it feels like once you get into that stuff where it's like, sounds like it's contradicting itself, and then you're just kind of going, I don't understand, mamma mia, I don't understand. But it really, you probably notice it just keeps saying the same things over and over and over again. They're just in different ways. Because it's not that hard. You know, it's actually pretty simple. It doesn't mean it's easy, and that's why we have all these teachings, because it's really easy to get caught up in our preferences, to get caught up in how we understand things. But the point, as Steve says, you have to see this. You know, you have to see this directly. You have to see that there's no inside, no outside, no in between. Right? Somebody tells you that, it doesn't really mean anything until you actually experience it. You actually see it. You see not self, rather than just hear about it. Hearing about it can be very confusing. I know when I first started here, like everyone else, I suspect, or like a lot of people, anyhow, I heard it. In spite of what the teachers are saying, I interpret it as no self. You know, and no self is the way sometimes it's talked about. So recently in a class, somebody was saying, wait a minute, isn't it no self? You know, and then, you know, you get caught up in words. Because if you understand what it's saying, then that wouldn't even be a thing to get to bring up. Because what it's really saying is, you know, not self. I mean, I don't really know else to put it. The way I put it for that student was moo. It's moo, which is like, the way I understand moo is it's just negation, right? So that the way that we put it together isn't even pertinent. You know what I mean? So it's no self in the fact that just putting a self in there isn't necessary. You know, but that's what we do. Anyhow, so we get caught up in this stuff. That's what makes it seem so difficult. So Steve says we don't have to be confused by or tormented by actual experience. We don't have to be confused by it. I would say if we're getting tormented, we're getting tormented by our confusion. You know, and I put that in there because we can be tormented by it. Especially if we're just kind of going, what does this mean? What does this mean? You know, how does this, you know, when life seems to be unfair, how come that happened? You know, that kind of thing. We can really torment ourselves about that. And one of the things that I think makes this difficult too is that when you encounter these teachings and they keep saying, come back to reality, you know, and you've already kind of figured the world out, and then the teachers are going, that's just an idea about reality. Come back to reality. You know, you start hearing, I'm not seeing reality correctly, you know. So that's also what makes this kind of difficult for us, is we think we're being told, oh, you're not seeing reality properly. You know, the truth of the matter, of course, is that you're always seeing reality. You're always experiencing exactly what these teachings are pointing out. This is hard. This is hard because it doesn't sound like it, but only if you can get out of the way of all that stuff, right? Before ideas sprout. And you're in that place before ideas sprout, that you can see that that's just a bunch of clutter. Otherwise, it's just not, it's not the way that it shows up for us. So we think we're being asked to see something that's not there. Enlightenment is seeing this like I've never seen it before. And I could say yes and no. It's actually as you're seeing it, but it's as you keep overlooking it because it's so mundane. It is so mundane. And I don't remember the context in which I was talking about this, but I was pointing out, you know, somebody was saying, it was the last session we had here. And Annie was talking about this experience she had at a session somewhere else. And she was saying that, you know, she really, the whole session, she'd been thinking about a guy she had a crush on. That's all that was going through her mind. Except apparently not in one moment, because somebody had, you know, at the end when we all sit in a circle and talk, you know, somebody said, you know, you really inspired me. I was watching the way you were drinking that coffee yesterday morning, and you were just wholeheartedly drinking that coffee. And she went, they're right. I was wholeheartedly drinking that coffee. You know, she goes, I love coffee. And that was probably the one moment where I wasn't thinking about that guy I had a crush on and trying to think about maybe inviting him over to my apartment, you know, whatever it was. So there was the moment where, you know, finally you stop getting caught up in the stuff. So it's right here. It's always right here for us. Our task, as Steve says, is really just to come back to that, to live it, not to let it go slipping by, And it goes slipping by only because we're always looking somewhere else. We're caught up in whatever it is. So this isn't asking us to throw reality out the window. It's asking us to actually engage with reality and to stop, injuring other people and animals and situations by putting your interpretation on it and then insisting that's the way it's got to be and then creating a lot of hell for everybody. And it may not even seem like hell at first, but I'm always surprised at just exactly what it is that I do that aggravates people. I'm unaware of it because I'm so busy doing my thing, and not paying attention to what's going on. So this is just coming back and actually living life. And Steve tells us we can do this by watching our preferences. And that's easy, isn't it? You know when you like something or you don't like something, or even when you're kind of blasé, you don't care one way or the other. You can see that. That is why the second noble truth is, and we often will hear it as, dukkha arises from desire, right? If you actually understand the teaching, you see it's showing us the whole 12-fold chain, right? Any one of those links on that chain, there's dukkha's arising because we've grabbed hold of it. But desire is the one we can see. It's the one we can feel. We know and we don't want something to be happening. We just know it. We can see that happening when you're sitting here and you're waiting for the meditation session to be done. You know what I mean? You just want it to be over with. You can see that. You can feel that. Or the opposite, when you're like, I'm in this state. Whatever it is that's going on, but you can see it. You can see you're wanting it or you're not wanting it, or again, your complete indifference to it. So that is what Steve tells us we can do. You start to see those preferences as they're showing up. You can see our aversions as they're showing up. And in doing that, the mind will straighten itself. Right? Again, the subtle part about this is we so easily get caught up in our ideas that we can go, yep, I see my preference, and then we're still acting out of it because we really haven't yet. We've just interpreted it. We've parceled it up as an idea. Oh, you heard the teaching. The teaching said do this. Got it. You did that. And now everything's going to take care. No, if all that is going on, you're still lost in thought, right? It's much more natural than that. It's not so heady. It's not so caught up in the brain, right? So as Steve says, how do you stop your mind from leaning? So here's the secret. You ready? Lean in. You're going to like this. He says, certainly not by making a direct effort to do so. Oh! This would be like trying to stop yourself from thinking of an elephant. He says, you have to conjure up an elephant to make sure you're not thinking of one. It can't be done. You can't apply your will to make your mind straighten up, because the very application of will is itself an inclination of mind. Right? That's like, I don't want this to be here, so I'm going to get rid of it. Do you know what I mean? And you have to be able to see that that's exactly the thing you think you're trying to get rid of, right? Instead, Steve says, it's enough to simply notice that your mind is leaning to the extent that you're aware it's leaning. That's a very important clause. To the extent that you're aware it's leaning, it straightens up on its own. So if it's not straightening up, you're not quite there yet. You're not really seeing what's showing up. Getting caught up in signs, falling into thought, chasing ideas when they sprout, these are all leanings of mind. As the mind straightens up, these states of mind all fall away naturally. What is left is what's been here all along, reality. It's only a matter of seeing. All right, so that's took me a little bit longer. When I did my talk, my computer was giving me all kinds of problems. And when I got to the end, I went, oh, that's a little bit on the long side, but I think I can get that in. And then when I was going over my talk this morning, I realized that a chunk of my talk was missing. So this is actually a slightly longer talk than I thought it was. Anyhow, any questions or observations or just anything that you want to bring up?
The sprout analogy reminded me of Thich Nhat Hanh's teaching about the fact that we have these seeds, anger, joy, and sorrow, and we, if we're aware, can decide which ones we nurture and grow at any given time. Yeah. It takes that awareness to become that plant.
Yeah. Yeah, the teaching of this, planting of seeds, I think, can be very helpful. So in this moment, whatever we're doing, however we're taking this or not taking this, right, that's the seed we're planting. And our next action, that's how we're watering or nurturing. Which plants are we nurturing? What is the pod, that one podcast I think Steve Hagen's been on once or twice called Which Wolf Do You Feed? Something like that. Yeah, which one are you going to nurture? Which one are you going to feed? Same kind of thing. And I like that. With every action, that's we're planting seeds. So are we planting purple bellflowers at that moment? Or are we planting carrots? You know? Yeah. That's great. I like that too. Oh, man. I'll tell you. I do remember carrots being tortured when I was a child. Because I loved them. And you couldn't tell. It was just like dirt for such a long time that you were just like, I think they're not going to grow, Grandpa. And Grandpa would be like, oh, don't worry about it. It's going to be fine. Yeah, well, that explains that. I loved them so much, I couldn't even wait to rinse them off when you pulled them out of the ground. You just knock them with your hand and get some minerals in there along with the carrot. Yeah. Yeah, anything else?
My husband and I had taken a class in Italian at the university, and it was really hard. So Thursday morning, we had an oral exam that we were going to do where we have to have a conversation with each other in front of the teacher, and she gives you a grade. And we got a notice from the university that it was expected that, you know, the snow was going to move through the area and that the campus might be closed Thursday. And yes! But then we kind of reprieved a little bit later. And we might have sort of cut back on our studying and sustaining. And, you know, everybody else was talking about, oh, what is going to do this? Oh, it's going to be like this. Oh, watch out, you know. And then 6 a.m. Thursday morning, we get a text. Well, everything's clear. Class is over. Don't ask. But you just see how it could be anything where there's some, I don't know, just somebody is, or somehow some potential has sort of been identified, and you grab onto that, and you know, it's not going to be that way. I'm not sure it's not going to be that way. You create this whole story, and it's interesting to watch.
That's great. There it was in all its naked glory. Yeah. Thanks for sharing. Anything else? All right, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.